The river cut a path through the forest under the cover of night, all the way to the fallow field at the edge of the southern wood. There it swirled and eddied, and tree upon tree, branch upon branch, a structure began to take form. All night the river worked, and when the townspeople arrived in the morning, they found Semyon standing beside a massive tower of timber that dwarfed the sad little pile of kindling, assembled by the prince's men. The prince hurled his ivory-handled axe away in anger, and the duke was most distressed. He could not break a promise made so publicly, but he could not bear the thought of his daughter married to such an unnatural creature as Semyon. He forced himself to smile and thump Semyon on his narrow back. "What fine work you've done," he declared. "I'm sure you will be just as successful at the second task." Semyon frowned. "But surely you did not think I would set only one task for Yeva's hand. I'm certain you can agree. My daughter is worth more than that." All the townspeople and eager suitors concurred, especially the prince, whose pride was still smarting. Semyon did not want anyone to think he priced Yeva so low. He swallowed his protest and nodded.
"Very good. Then listen closely. A girl like Yeva must be able to behold her own lovely face. High in the Petrozoi lives Baba Anezka, the maker of mirrors. Whoever returns with a piece of her handiwork will have my daughter as his bride."
The suitors scattered in all directions while the prince called orders to his men. When her father had returned to the palace and Yeva heard what he had done, she said, "Papa, forgive me, but what way is this to find a husband? Soon I will have a fine mirror, but will I have a good man?"
"Darling Yeva," said the duke, "when will you learn to trust in your father's wisdom? The prince has Ravka's fastest horses, and only he can afford such a mirror. He will win this contest easily, and then you will wear a jeweled crown and eat cherries in winter. What do you think of that?"
Yeva wondered if her father had simply misheard her question, but she kissed his cheek and told him she was very fond of cherries indeed. Semyon went down to the river and put his head in his hands.
"What am I to do?" he said miserably. "I have no horse, nor have I money to trade with the mountain witch. You helped me before. But what good are you now, river?"
Then Semyon gasped as the river once more breached its banks and grabbed hold of his ankle. It dragged him into its depths as he sputtered and gasped.
"River!" cried Semyon. "What do you do?"
The river burbled its reply, dunking him deep, then buoying him to the surface and carrying him safely along. It bore him south through lakes and creeks and rapids, west through tributaries and streams, mile after mile until finally they came to the north-facing slopes of the Petrozoi, and Semyon understood the river's intent.
"Faster, river, faster!" he commanded as it carried him up the mountainside,
and soon enough he arrived soaked but triumphant at the entrance to the witch's cave.
"You have been a loyal friend, and so I think I must name you," Semyon said to the river
as he tried to wring the water from his ragged coat.
"I will call you Little Knife, because of the way you flash silver in the sunlight, and because you are my fierce defender."
Then he knocked on the witch's door.
"I have come for a mirror," he shouted.
Baba Anezka opened the door, her teeth sharp and straight, her eyes golden and unblinking. Only then did Semyon remember he had no coin with which to pay. But before the ancient fabricator could shut the door in his face, the river splashed its way through, eddying around Baba Anezka's feet, and then back out again. Baba Anezka greeted the river with a bow, and with Semyon on her heels, followed the river over a high ridge and through a path hidden between two flat rocks. As they squeezed through, they found themselves at the edge of a shallow valley, its floor all gray gravel, barren and unwelcoming as the rest of the Petrozoi, but at its center lay a pool, nearly perfect in its roundness, its surface smooth as highly polished glass, reflecting the sky so purely that it looked as if one could step into it and fall straight through the clouds. The witch smiled, showing all her sharp teeth.
"Now this is a mirror," she said, "and seems a fair trade."
They returned to the cave, and when Baba Anezka handed Semyon one of her finest mirrors, he laughed in his joy.
"That gift is for the river," she said. "It belongs to Little Knife, and Little Knife does as I ask. Besides, what could a river want with a mirror?" "That is a question for the river," replied Baba Anezka.
But Semyon ignored her. He called out for Little Knife, and once more the river grabbed his ankle, and they went rushing down the mountainside together. When they roared past the prince's caravan, trudging along the path, the soldiers turned to look but only saw a great wave and a white curl of foam. Once they arrived in Velisiana, Semyon put on his least threadbare tunic, combed his hair, and did his best to polish his boots. When he checked his reflection in the mirror, he was surprised at the sullen face and inky eyes that stared back at him. He'd always thought himself quite handsome, and the river had never told him differently.
"There is something wrong with this mirror, Little Knife," he said. "But this is what the Duke demanded, and so Yeva shall have it for her wall."
When the Duke looked out his window and saw Semyon striding across Suitor's Square with a mirror in his hands, he reeled back in shock.
"See what you have done with your foolish tasks," said the retired colonel, who was awaiting the contest's outcome with the Duke. "You should have given me Yeva's hand when you had the chance. Now she will be married to that outcast, and no one will want to sit at your table. You must find a way to be rid of him."
But the Duke was not so sure. A prince would make a fine son-in-law, but Semyon must have great power to accomplish such extraordinary tasks, and the Duke wondered if he might make use of such magic. He sent the colonel away, and when Semyon knocked on the palace door, the Duke welcomed him with much ceremony. He sat Semyon in a place of honor, and had the servants wash his hands with perfumed water, then gave him sugared almonds, plum brandy, bowls of lamb dumplings resting in nests of muskmallow. Semyon had never eaten so well, and he'd certainly never been treated as a beloved guest. When at last he sat back, his belly ached and his eyes were bleary with wine and flattery. The Duke said,
"Semyon, we are both honest men and so can speak freely with each other. You are a clever fellow, but how can you hope to care for one such as Yeva? You have no work, no home, no prospects."
"I have love," said Semyon, nearly toppling his glass.
"And Little Knife."
The Duke didn't know what knives had to do with anything, but he said,
"One cannot live on love or cutlery, and Yeva has had an easy life. She knows nothing of struggle or hardship. Would you be the one to teach her suffering?"
"No," cried Semyon. "Never."
"Then we must make a plan, you and I. Tomorrow I will set a final task, and if you accomplish it, then you will have Yeva's hand and all the riches you could ever want."
Semyon thought the Duke might try to cheat him once more, but he liked the sound of this bargain, and resolved to be on his guard.
"Very well," he said, and offered the Duke his hand. The Duke shook it, hiding his distaste, then said,
"Come to the square tomorrow morning and listen closely."
Word of the new task spread, and the next day the square was packed with even more suitors, including the prince, who stood with his tired horses, his boots glittering with tiny shards of the mirror he had smashed in his frustration.
"There is an ancient coin, forged by a great sorcerer and buried somewhere beneath Ravka," the Duke declared. "Each time you spend it, it returns to you twofold, so your pockets will always be full." Bring back this coin, so that Yeva will never want for anything, and you will have her as your bride."
The crowd raced off in all directions to gather shovels and pickaxes. When the Duke stepped back from the balcony, Yeva said,
"Papa, forgive me, but what way is this to find a husband? Soon I will be very rich. But will I have a good man?"
This time, the Duke looked on his daughter with pity.
"When the coffers are empty and their bellies growl, even good men turn bad. Whoever may win this contest, the magic coin will be ours. We will dance in marble halls and drink from cups of frozen amber. And if you do not like your husband, we will drown him in a sea of gold, then send a silver ship to find you a new one. What do you think of that?"
Yeva sighed. Weary of asking questions that went unanswered, she kissed her father's cheek and went to say her prayers. The prince called all his advisers together. The royal engineer brought him a machine that required 50 men to turn the crank. Once it was spinning, it could drill for miles beneath the earth. But the engineer did not know how to stop it, and the machine and the 50 men were never heard from again. The Minister of the Interior claimed he could train an army of moles if he only had more time, and the king's spymaster swore that he had heard stories of a magic spoon that could dig through solid rock. Meanwhile, Semyon returned to the river.
"Little knife," he called, "I need you. If I do not find the coin, then another man will have Yeva, and I will have nothing."
The river splashed, its surface rippling in consternation. It sloshed against its banks, returning again and again to break upon the dam that bound the mill pond. It took many minutes, but soon Semyon understood. The river was divided, too weak to dig beneath the ground. He snatched up the ivory-handled axe he had taken from the woods when the prince had cast it away, and hacked at the dam with all his might. The clang of Grisha steel against stone echoed through the forest until finally, with a creaking sigh, the dam burst. The river roiled and frothed in its newfound strength, whole once more.
"Now slice through the ground and fetch me the coin, little knife, or what good are you to me?"
The river dove through the earth, moving with strength and purpose, leaving caverns and caves and tunnels in its wake. It crossed the length of Ravka, from border to border and back, as the rock tore at its current and the soil drank from its sides. The deeper the river plunged, the weaker it became, but on it went, and when it was at its most frail, little more than a breath of fog and a clump of earth, it felt the coin, small and hard. Whatever face the metal bore had been long worn away by time. The river clutched the coin and hurtled to the surface, gathering its strength, growing dense with mud and rainwater, swelling as it reclaimed each rivulet and tiny stream. It erupted through the mill pond, a gout of mist that glittered with rainbows, bouncing the coin this way and that. Semyon bounded into the water to seize it, but the river swirled around him, making worried murmurs. Semyon paused and wondered, "What if I bring the coin to the Duke, and he sets yet another task? What if he takes it and murders me where I sit?" "I am no fool," Semyon said to the river. "Keep the coin in the shallows until I return." Once more Semyon combed his hair and shined his boots, and made the walk to the Duke's home. There he pounded on the door and announced that he had found the final prize.
"Call the priest," he demanded. "Let Yeva be dressed in her finery. We will say our vows by the river, and then I will give you your magic coin."
So Yeva was attired in a dress of gold and a thick veil to hide her miraculous face. The blind nursemaid cried softly as she hugged Yeva one last time and helped to secure a jeweled kokoshnik in her hair. Then Yeva was led down to the river with her father and the priest, trailing all the townspeople and the grumbling prince behind them. They found Semyon by the shattered dam, the river spilling its banks.
"What has happened here?"
asked the Duke. Semyon still wore his threadbare rags, but now he spoke with pride.
"I have your coin," he said. "Give me my bride."
The Duke held out his hand in expectation.
"Show them, little knife,"
said Semyon to the seething waters. Yeva frowned.
"What is little about the river?" she asked,
but no one heard her question. The coin shot from the river's depths to skip and dance on its surface.
"It's true," exclaimed the Duke. "By all the saints, he has found it."
The Duke, Semyon, and the prince all reached for the coin, and the river roared. It seemed to hunch its back like a beast preparing to charge, a wild, pulsing swell that crested over the crowd.
"Stop this," demanded Semyon.
But the river did not stop. It twisted and turned, forming a mighty column that churned with reeds and broken rocks, rising high above the forest floor, as the onlookers cowered in fear.
What did they see in its waters?
Some would later say a demon. Others, the pale and bloated bodies of 100 drowned men. But most said they saw a woman with arms like breaking waves, with hair like storm cloud lightning, and breasts of white foam.
"Little knife," cried Semyon. "What do you do?"
A voice spoke, terrible in its power, rumbling with the sound of rain-choked waterfalls, of tempests and floods.
"I am no blunt knife to cut your sorry bread," it said. "I feed the fields and drown the harvest. I am bounty and destruction."
The people fell to their knees and wept. The Duke clutched the priest's hand.
"Then who are you?" begged Semyon.
"What are you?" "Your tongue is not fit for my true name," the river boomed. "I was once a spirit of the Isenvi, the great North Sea, and I roamed these lands freely, tumbling down through Fjerda to the rocky coast and back again. Then, by unhappy accident, my spirit was trapped here, bound by this dam, free to run but doomed to return, forced to keep that cursed wheel spinning in endless service to this miserable hamlet. Now the dam is no more. Your greed and the prince's axe have seen to that."
It was Yeva who found the courage to speak, for the question to ask seemed simple.
"What do you want, river?"
"It was I who built the Tower of Trees," said the river, "and I who earned the mirror from Baba Anezka. It was I who found the magic coin, and now I say to you, Yeva Luchova, will you remain here with the father who tried to sell you, or the prince who hoped to buy you, or the man too weak to solve his riddles for himself? Or will you come with me and be bride to nothing but the shore?"
Yeva looked at Semyon, at the prince, at her father standing beside the priest. Then she tore the veil from her face. Her eyes were bright, her cheeks were flushed and glowing. The people cried out and shielded their gazes, for in that moment she was too lovely to look at. She was terrifying in her beauty, bright like a devouring star. Yeva leapt from the banks, and the river caught her up in its waters, keeping her afloat as her jeweled kokoshnik sank, and her silken gown billowed around her. She hovered there on the surface, a flower caught in the current. Then, as the Duke stood stunned and quaking in his wet boots, the river wrapped Yeva in its arms and carried her away. Through the woods the river thundered, leaving trees and fields drenched by her eddying skirts, smashing the mill to bits in her wake. The water wheel snapped free of its moorings and rolled wildly down the banks, knocking the prince and all his retainers to the ground before disappearing into the underbrush. The townspeople trembled against one another, and when the river was finally gone, they looked upon the empty riverbed, its damp rocks glittering in the sun. Where the mill pond had been only minutes before, there was just a muddy basin,
There was quiet, no sound but the croak of lost frogs, and the slap of gasping fish flopping in the muck. The river was the heart of Veliciana, and when it went silent, all that was left was for the town to die. Without the river there could be no mill, and without the mill the Duke lost his fortune. When he begged for relief from the king, the prince suggested that his father set 3 tasks and that the price for failure be the Duke's head. The Duke left the capital in disgrace, but with his head still on his shoulders. The shops and houses of Veliciana emptied. The grates lay cold, and the clock on the bell tower chimed its hour for no one. The Duke remained in his crumbling palace, gazing out from Yeva's window onto the empty stones of Suter's Square, and cursing Semyon. If you keep very still, you may see him there, surrounded by stone lilies, awaiting the water's return. But you will not glimpse lovely Yeva. The river carried her all the way to the seashore, and there she stayed. She said her prayers in a tiny chapel where the waves ran right up to the door, and each day she sat by the ocean's edge and watched the tides come and go. She lived in happy solitude, and grew old, and never worried when her beauty faded, for in her reflection she always saw a free woman. As for poor Semyon, he was driven out of town, blamed for the tragedy that had befallen it. His misery was short, however. Not long after he left Veliciana, he withered to a husk and died. He would not let any drop of water pass his lips, certain it would betray him. Now, if you have been foolish enough to wander from the path, it is up to you to make your way back to the road. Follow the voices of your worried companions, and perhaps this time your feet will lead you past the rusting skeleton of a water wheel resting in a meadow where it has no right to be. If you are lucky, you will find your friends again. They will pat you on the back and soothe you with their laughter. But as you leave that dark gap in the trees behind, remember that to use a thing is not to own it. And should you ever take a bride, listen closely to her questions. In them you may hear her true name, like the thunder of a lost river, like the sighing of the sea. The Soldier Prince. In the end, the clocksmith was to blame, but Mr. and Mrs. Zelverhaus should not have let him into the house. This is the problem with even lesser demons. They come to your doorstep in velvet coats and polished shoes. They tip their hats and smile and demonstrate good table manners. They never show you their tails. The clocksmith was called Drosen. Though there were rumors he was not Kirch, but Ravkin, an exiled nobleman's son, or possibly a disgraced fabricator, banished from his homeland for reasons unknown. His shop was on Wiegenstraat, where the canal crooked like a finger beckoning you closer, and he was known the world over for his fantastical timepieces, for the little bronze birds that sang different songs at every hour, and for the tiny wooden men and women who played out amusing scenes at midnight, then again at noon. He'd risen to fame when he'd built a clockwork fortune-teller that when a certain lever was pulled would move its polished wooden hand over your palm and predict your future. A merchant brought his daughter to the shop before her wedding. The fortune-teller had clicked and clanked, opened its wooden jaws, and said, "You will find great love and more gold than you could wish for." He bought the clever automaton for his beloved child as a wedding gift. And everyone who attended the celebration agreed they'd never seen a bride and groom more in love. But the ship his daughter boarded to begin her honeymoon was so heavily weighted with goods and coin that it sank at the first breath of a storm, and all were lost to the uncaring sea. When the news reached the merchant, he remembered the automaton's clever words and, drunk on misery and brandy, smashed the thing to bits with his own fists.
His servants found him lying amid the wreckage the next day, still weeping, shirt stained, knuckles bloody. But the sad tale drew new customers to the clocksmith's door in search of the marvelous and uncanny. In his shop they found many wonders, tawny golden lions who hunted mechanical gazelles across a velvet veldt, a garden of enamel flowers pollinated by jeweled hummingbirds that whirred and buzzed on wires so thin they truly seemed to be flying, a rotating calendar clock kept on the highest shelf, away from curious young eyes, populated by human automata, who committed different ghastly murders every month. On the 1st of January, a duel was fought on an icy field, puffs of smoke emerging from the combatants' pistols with tinny pops. In February, a man climbed atop his wife to strangle her, as her lover cowered beneath the rumpled bed, and so on. Despite his accomplishments, Throsen was still a young man, and he became a coveted party guest among the merchant families who served as his customers. He dressed well, conversed pleasantly, and always brought charming gifts to his hosts. It was true that when he entered a room, the people there would find themselves shifting uneasily on their feet, rubbing their arms at the sudden chill, wondering if a door somewhere needed closing. Yet, somehow, it only made him more interesting. Without that sense of the unwholesome, Drosen might have been a pathetic character, a grown man fiddling with what were little more than elaborate toys. Instead, there was much talk of his smart velvet coat and his nimble white fingers. Mamas clutched their handkerchiefs, and daughters blushed when he was near. Every winter, the Zelverhausses, a wealthy family of tea merchants, hosted the clocksmith at their country home for the parties and entertainments given during the week of Nachtspiel. The house itself was a model of merchant restraint, all dark wood, stolid brick, and hard lines. But it was perfectly situated by a lake that froze early for skating, and it was effusive in its comforts, with fireplaces alight in each room to keep the house always snug and merry, and every floor polished to the warm syrup shine of a glazed cake. From the very first year Drosen visited the house by the lake, troubling rumors followed. During his first stay, the Zelverhaus's neighbors, the de Klotz, wore mourning through Nachtspiel and into the new year, after Elise de Klot gave birth to a baby composed entirely of dandelion fluff. When a careless maid opened a window, it blew away at the first gust. The next year, one of the Zelverhaus cousins had a bloom of little gray mushrooms break out over her forehead, and a boy visiting from Liege claimed he'd woken to find a single wing jutting from between his shoulder blades, but that it had burned to ash when he'd passed through a sunbeam in the hall. Were these strange occurrences linked to the clocksmith? No one could be certain, but they whispered about it. "That young man Drosen is a charming fellow, but most unusual, and peculiarity seemed to follow him," a woman once said to Althea Zelverhaus. "Most unusual," Althea agreed. But she knew that Drosen accepted few invitations, and that this woman with her fussy lace collar could only hope Drosen might someday make an appearance at one of her salons. So Althea smiled, repeated, "Most unusual indeed," and left it at that. It all seemed harmless at the time. Drosen was not just unusual in his talents or his habits, but also in his greed. He had spent his life tinkering in corners, bowing and scraping to the merchants who graced his door, and he had learned early that talent was not enough. When he realized customers preferred to buy from handsome faces, he had his hair cut into a fashionable style and made himself a set of even white teeth so fine they sometimes fooled even him. When he saw the respect his patrons gave military men, he'd worn a painful brace to correct his stoop, and had the shoulders of his jackets padded so that he could affect a soldier's upright bearing.
Because he'd discerned that popularity was dependent upon demand, he made sure to refuse 2 out of every 3 invitations. But he grew tired of eating cold dinners in his darkened shop, the doors locked and lights turned off to create the illusion that he was somewhere having fun. He wanted a grand house instead of a dank rented room. He wanted money for his inventions. He never wanted to have to say, yes, sir, no, sir, right away, sir, again. So he would have to marry well. But whom could he make his bride? The young women of marriageable age who came into his shop with their fathers and flirted with him at parties saw him as a bit of danger. They would never take a mere tradesman seriously as a prospect. No, he needed a girl, still malleable. One that he could make admire him. Clara Zelverhaus was not yet 12 then, lovely enough, rich enough, and of just the dreamy disposition he required. He could learn her wants and wishes. He would deliver them to her, and in time she would come to love him for it. Or so he thought. Drosen knew the properties of every kind of wood and paint and lacquer. He could finesse the gears of a clock until they spun with silent precision. And yet, though he could smile readily, charm easily, and play the part of a gentleman, he had never truly understood people, or the workings of their steady-running but inconstant hearts. The house by the lake bustled with excitement whenever the clocksmith arrived. And the children were always first to greet him when he emerged from his coach. They would trail after the house servants who unloaded his luggage, the trunks and chests invariably filled with splendid objects, dolls in the costumes of the Comédie Brute, music boxes, rows of cannons, even a grand castle to defend. Though young Frederick liked to stage long battles, he would eventually grow bored. No matter how finely made the tiny armaments and troops, and put on his coat to go find mischief in the snow. Clara was different. To Drosen's dismay, she ignored the elaborate clockworks and mechanicals he brought her, and spared only a small smile for the exquisite replica of a Ravkin palace, with its carved wooden arches and domes, plated in real gold. But she could play for hour upon hour with the dolls he made, vanishing into the house and emerging only when the dinner bell had been rung more than once, and her mother had been forced to shout up the stairs and down every corridor for Clara to cease her make-believe and come be fed. So over many long nights in his workshop, Drosen made for her an elegant pale-eyed nutcracker with a bright blue coat and shiny black boots. A wicked little bayonet tucked into one blocky fist.
"You must tell him all your secrets," said Drosen as he placed the doll in Clara's arms. "And he will keep them safe for you."
She promised that she would. Clara's mother and father assumed that, as she grew older, Clara would leave such childish things behind and begin to care more for dresses. And the prospect of a husband and a family, as her friends did. But as the years passed, Clara stayed the same strange, dreamy girl, who might let a sentence trail off because some secret, unspoken thought had caught her, who would endure language lessons and cotillions with distracted grace, then smile and drift off to some dim corner where whatever invisible world her mind had conjured might unfurl without distraction. When Clara turned 16, her parents threw her a grand party. She ate sweets, teased her brother, and danced beautifully with every eligible merchant's son in attendance. Althea Zelverhaus heaved a happy sigh of relief and went to bed without a worry for the first time in months. But that night, when she woke from her sleep, she had the sudden need to check on her children. Frederick, 17 and happy to be home from school, snored loudly in his room. Clara's bed was empty. Althea found Clara curled on her side by the hearth in the dining room, one of her favorite dolls in her arms. She saw that her daughter had put on her slippers and coat, and that both were wet with snow.
"Clara,"
her mother whispered, rocking her shoulder gently to rouse her from sleep.
Why did you go outside?
Clara blinked drowsily at her mother and smiled a sweet, vague smile.
He loves the snow, she said,
then clutched her doll closer and fell back into slumber. Althea looked down at her daughter in her nightgown and damp coat, the ugly little face of the wooden doll in her arms. It was Althea's least favorite of Drosen's creations, a nutcracker with a grotesque smile and garish blue coat. Standing there, she had the sudden thought that inviting the clocksmith into her home years ago had been a terrible mistake. Her fingers itched to snatch the doll from Clara and tossed the wretched thing into the fire. She reached for the nutcracker, then yanked her hand back. For a moment, it could not be, and yet she was sure of it. It seemed the toy soldier had turned his square head to look at her, and there had been sorrow in his eyes.
Nonsense, she told herself, cradling her hand to her chest.
You are becoming as fanciful as Clara. Even so, she stepped away, certain that if she dared touch the nutcracker, dared throw it into the flames, the thing would cry out. Or worse, it might not burn at all. She put a blanket over her daughter and returned to her own bed, and when she woke the next morning, she'd all but forgotten her foolish notions of the night before. Knockspell was beginning, and her guests would soon arrive. She rose and rang for tea, seeking fortification for the arduous day ahead. But when she went downstairs to see the menus, she checked to make sure that Clara was sorting chestnuts with the cook, and paused once by the cabinet in the dining room where they displayed Drosen's gifts. Not for any reason, really. Certainly not to make sure that the nutcracker was safely locked away behind the glass. Clara knew her mother worried. She worried, too. When she was seated at dinner, or at some party with a friend, or even occasionally at her lessons, she would think, "This is pleasant. This is enough." But then she'd arrive back home, and she'd find herself in the dining room in front of the cabinet. She'd reach once more for the nutcracker and take him to her bedroom or up to the attic, where she would lie on her side amid the dust motes, and whisper to him until he whispered back. It always took some time and felt a bit awkward at the start. It had been easier when she was a child, but she was self-conscious now in a way she hadn't been then. Clara felt foolish moving the nutcracker's arms, making his jaws open and close to answer her questions. She couldn't help but see herself as others would, a young woman, nearly grown, lying on a dusty attic floor, talking to a doll. But she persisted, reminding him of the adventures they'd had, though they had changed a bit over the years. "You are a soldier. You fought bravely on the front, and returned to me, your darling. You killed a monster for me once, a rat with seven heads, on the last evening of Knockspell. You are a prince I woke from a curse with a kiss. I loved you when no other would, and you chose me for your queen." She would place a walnut between his hard teeth, then crack, the noise so loud in the still attic. "Are you my soldier?" she would ask again and again. "Are you my prince? Are you my darling? Are you mine?" And at last, sometimes after mere moments, sometimes after what seemed like forever, his jaws would move and he would speak. "Are you my soldier?"
"I am."
"Are you my prince?"
"I am."
As he spoke, his limbs would grow, his chest would broaden, his skin would turn supple.
"Are you my darling?"
"I am."
"Are you mine?"
"Sweet Clara," the nutcracker would say, tall and handsome and perfect now, the grotesque rictus of his face softened into tender human lines. "Of course I am."
He would offer her his hand, and with a whoosh they would fly through the attic window, out into the cold. She would find herself atop a great white horse, clutching her beloved's waist,
whooping with joy as they sailed through the night, past the clouds, and into the lands beyond. She did not know what to call the place he brought her to. Fairyland? The land of dreaming? When she was a child, it had looked different. They'd ridden a sponge sugar boat on a sweet water stream. She'd walked on marzipan cobblestones, past gingerbread villages and castles made of marmalade. Children had danced for them and greeted the Nutcracker as their prince. They'd sat on gumdrop cushions, and his mother had called Clara a hero. Now much of that was gone, replaced by deep green forests and shining rivers. The air was warm and silken, like the places she'd read about. Summer lands where the sun shone all year, and balmy breezes were thick with the scent of orange blossoms. The white horse carried them to new places every time, a valley where wild ponies with manes of mist ranged, a quicksilver lake as big as a sea, where they met with dashing pirates who had gems for teeth, a palace of dogwood walls and larkspur towers that rose from a grove where clouds of butterflies hovered, wings chiming like bells. The queen there had pale green skin, perpetually dotted with dew, and her crown rose like antlers directly from her forehead, in twists of bone that gleamed like mother of pearl. When she touched her lips to Clara's mouth, Clara felt two delicate wings sprout from her back. She spent the day flying, swooping and dropping like a hummingbird, pausing only to drink honey wine, and let the queen twine hellebore into her hair. And yet it was not enough. Did her prince love her? Could he? Why did he return her to her home at the end of every magical journey? It wasn't fair to show her that such a world could exist and then take it from her so cruelly. If he loved her as she loved him, surely she would be allowed to stay. At every visit she hoped his mother would greet her as a daughter rather than a guest, that she would open a new door on a wedding bower. Instead, the dinner gong would sound, or she'd hear Frederick stomping up the stairs, or her mother's voice calling, and she would find herself sailing back through the starry sky to the cold, empty attic, her joints stiff from lying on the slats of the floor, the hard body of the Nutcracker beside her, shrunken and ugly, the leavings of walnuts between his wooden jaws. She would place him back in the cabinet and return to her parents. She would try to smile at the drab world around her, though her cheeks were still warm with sunshine, though her tongue was still sweet with the taste of honey wine. As for the Nutcracker, he was sure of nothing, and sometimes it frightened him. His memories were a blur. He knew there had been a battle, many battles, and that he'd fought bravely. Hadn't he been made for it? He had been born with a bayonet in hand. He'd fought for her, but where was she now? Where was Clara? She of the star eyes and soft hands. They'd faced the Rat King together. She'd wrapped him in her kerchief. He'd bled into its white lace folds. Clara. Why could he remember her name and not his own? He'd fought bravely. At least he thought he had. The details were hard to recall. The screams, the blood, the squealing of the rats with their thick pink tails and teeth like yellow knives, gums red with blood from the bites they'd taken. How those teeth had glistened in the golden light. Had it been sunrise or sunset? He remembered the smell of pines. He squinted now, from his place in the barracks, through the wide plate glass window. But the view confused him, too. He could see a long table set for a feast, candied fruit, pine boughs laid upon the mantel. But everything was far too large, as if seen through a distorting lens. He counted the brass buttons on his fine blue coat. Whose uniform did he wear? Which country was his home? Who had polished the dust of the battlefield from his boots? Had there been a battle? Had he fought? Or only dreamed of fighting? Other memories seemed clearer. He was a prince. Her prince. She'd told him so. He'd wanted nothing more than to show her all the wonders of his home, to explore its endless horizons. And yet, why did he feel no gladness when he returned to the palace, where he supposed he had been raised? Why was everything as new to him as it seemed to be to her? Nothing felt certain. He was sure the streets they'd walked had been narrow before, bordered by houses with frosted roofs, instead of wide boulevards that swept past mansions tiled in gold. Gifts of nougat and sweet cream had pleased Clara before, but now he gave her jewels and gowns because he knew she would prefer them. How he came by this knowledge he could not fathom. He watched the people at the table, giants it seemed, and yet there was Clara, who he'd held in his arms. Sometimes her eyes strayed to him and he tried to cry out to her, but he had no voice, no way to move his limbs. He must have been injured. He watched her eat her supper and speak to... It took him a moment to remember. Frederick, her brother, a commander in the war, bold and sometimes reckless, but the Nutcracker had executed every order given. There was another familiar face at the table, a man with long hair and pale blue eyes, who studied Clara as if she were a piece of machinery to be taken apart and put back together. I know him, thought the Nutcracker. Drosen. I know his name. But he could not think how. The man did not look like a soldier, though he had the bearing of one. A memory clawed up through the Nutcracker's thoughts. He was lying on his back, staring at shelves packed with clocks and slumped marionettes. He smelled paint and oil, the fresh shavings of wood. Drosen loomed over him, huge and cold-eyed, with terrible focus. I was wounded, thought the Nutcracker. Drosen must be a surgeon then. But that wasn't quite right. The meal ended. The guests drank little glasses of garnet-colored liquid. Clara sipped at hers, cheeks flushed. They played games before the fire, and someone shouted, "It's snowing!" They raced to gather around the great window, but the Nutcracker could not see well enough to tell what interested them so. There was talk and laughter, and then they were all racing out of the dining room to... He did not know. He did not know what lay beyond this room. It might be a palace, or a prison, or a pine grove. He knew only that they were gone. Servants came and banked the fire, doused the candles. He'd fought bravely. And yet somehow he always ended up here, alone in the dark. Clara did not come that night. The Nutcracker awoke to shrill squeaking and found the Rat King at his bedside. He sat up hurriedly and reached for his saber, realizing as he grasped at his sword belt that his weapon was gone, and at the same time that he could move again.
"Peace, Captain," the Rat King said. "I have not come to fight, only to talk."
His voice was high and reedy, and his whiskers twitched, yet the monster still managed to look grave when he spoke. This creature had the Nutcracker's blood on his filthy paws, and would have murdered Clara, too. But, if he came to speak under conditions of a truce, the Nutcracker supposed he must honor that. He dipped his chin the barest amount. The Rat King adjusted his felt cloak and looked around.
"Do you have anything to drink? If only they'd stuck you in a liquor cabinet, eh?"
Cabinet. The Nutcracker frowned at the word. He'd been resting in the barracks, had he not? And yet, as he looked around, he saw that what had simply seemed the vague shapes of beds and other soldiers were strange items indeed. Girls with glass eyes and stiffly curled hair were propped against the wall. Rows of soldiers with bayonets at their shoulders marched in frozen lockstep.
"I don't know,"
he replied at last. The Rat King perched on the gilded lip of an enormous music box. But was it enormous? Or were they small?
When was the last time you ate?
He asked. The Nutcracker hesitated. Had it been with Clara? In the land of snow? The court of flowers?
I can't recall.
The Rat King sighed.
You should eat something.
I do eat.
Surely he did.
Something other than walnuts.
The Rat King scratched behind his ear with his little pink claws, then removed the crown from his gray head and placed it gently in his lap.
Do you know I started life as a sugar mouse?
The Nutcracker's confusion must have shown, for the Rat King continued.
I realize that's hard to believe, but I was just a confection. Not even for eating. Just for looking at. A charming little marvel. A testament to my maker's skill. It seemed a shame that I should go untasted. My first thought was, I wish someone would eat me. But that was enough.
Enough for what?
To get free of the cabinet. Wanting is why people get up in the morning. It gives them something to dream of at night. The more I wanted, the more I became like them, the more real I became.
I am perfectly real, protested the Nutcracker.
The Rat King looked at him sadly, sitting there without his crown in the dim light, his whiskers drooping slightly. He looked less like a dreadful monster than a sweet-faced mouse. A memory came to the Nutcracker.
You had 7 heads.
The Rat King nodded.
Clara imagined me fearsome, and so fearsome I became. But a rat can't live with 7 heads always talking and arguing. It took us hours to make the simplest decisions, so when the others were asleep, I cut them from me one by one. There was an awful amount of blood.
He shifted slightly in his seat.
Who are you when she isn't here, Captain?
I am, he wavered. I am a soldier.
Are you? What is your rank? Lieutenant?
Lieutenant, of course,
answered the Nutcracker.
Or is it Captain?
The Rat King inquired.
Are you my soldier? Are you my prince?
Surely
you must know your rank.
Are you my darling?
Who are you when no one picks you up to hold you?
Asked the Rat King.
When no one is looking at you or whispering to you, who are you then? Tell me your name, soldier.
Are you mine?
The Nutcracker opened his mouth to answer, but he could not recall. He was Clara's prince, her protector. He had a name. Of course he had a name. Only the shock of battle had driven it from his mind. He'd fought bravely. He'd taken Clara to meet his mother. He'd ridden a horse through a gleaming field of stars. He was heir to nothing. He was prince of a marzipan palace. He slept on sponge sugar. He slept on gold.
You walk and talk and laugh when Clara dreams with you, said the Rat King. But those are her desires. They cannot sustain you. My life began with wanting something for myself. I wished to be eaten. Then I wished to eat a piece of cake, a bit of bacon, a sip of wine. I wanted these things from their table. That was when I moved my legs and blinked my eyes. I wanted to see beyond the cabinet door. That was when I found my way into the walls. There I met my rat brothers. They are not charming or pretty, but they live, even when no one is looking. I have made a life in the walls with them, unwatched and undesired. I know who I am without anyone there to tell me.
But why did you attack us?
Said the Nutcracker.
The blood, the screaming. I know that was real.
as real as anything. When Clara was a child, she dreamed of heroes. And heroes require a foe. But the desire to conquer was the will she gave me, not my own. It is simple hunger that keeps me alive now. Crumbs from the cupboard, cheese in the larder, a chance to venture outside to the woodpile, see the wide sky, feel the cold bite of the snow.
Snow. Another memory emerged. Not the place of dreaming that Clara so longed for, but a new place beyond the cabinet. She had taken him outside one night. He had felt cold. He had seen clouds moving over the starlit sky. He had taken the air into his lungs, felt them expand, exhaled, seen the puff of his breath in the chill night. He remembered trees clustered against the horizon, a road, the desperate desire to see what lay beyond it.
"That's it, Captain,"
said the Rat King, as he slowly rose and placed the crown back atop his head.
"It helps to live in the shelter of the walls, where there are no human eyes to look upon me. It helps to be a rat who no one wants to look at. Your desire must be stronger if you wish to get free of the cabinet, if you wish to be real. She loves you, though, and that will make it harder."
Clara loved him, and he loved her, didn't he? The Rat King nudged open the cabinet door.
"One last thing,"
he said as he skittered onto the ledge.
"Beware of Drosen. You were meant to be a gift to Clara, a means of enchanting her, and nothing more."
"He loves her too, then?"
"Who knows what the clocksmith loves? Best not to ask. I think the answer would please no one."
The Rat King vanished, his pink tail slithering behind him. Clara tried to stay away. She managed it for a night, the wine and the guests a happy distraction. But the next day she snuck from the skating out on the lake and ran to the cabinet, clutching the nutcracker beneath her coat and racing up the stairs to the quiet of the attic. "Are you my soldier?" she whispered as the cold winter light made bright squares on the dusty floor. "Are you my prince?" she tucked a walnut between his jaws. "Are you my darling? Are you mine?" It did not take long this time. The nutcracker's body stretched and his head split to reveal her handsome prince's face.
"I am," he said.
He smiled as he always did, touched his gentle hand to her face, but then trouble came into his eyes. He pressed his fingertips to his mouth, licked his lips, and frowned as if the taste of walnuts did not agree with him. "Where will we go today, my prince?" Clara asked. But he did not take her hand. He sat up, ran his fingers through the beam of sunlight from the window, and then rose to peer out through the glass.
"Outside," he said. "I'd like to see where that road goes."
The request was so ordinary and yet so unexpected, Clara couldn't quite make sense of it for a moment. "That isn't possible."
"It's what I want."
He said the words as if he'd made some great discovery, a new invention, a magic spell. His smile was radiant.
"Dear Clara, it's what I want."
"But it cannot be," she replied, unsure of how to explain. His cheer vanished, and she saw fear in his eyes.
"I cannot return to the cabinet."
Now she understood. At last. At last. She took his hands. "You need never return to the cabinet. Only take me with you to your home, and I will forsake this place. We can stay forever in the land of dreams." He hesitated.
"That is what you want?"
"Yes," said Clara, tilting her head up. "It is what I have always wanted." The fervor of it filled her. Sweat broke out over her neck. "Kiss me," she willed him. In all the stories, a kiss was required. "Take me from this place." She could not wait. Clara stood on tiptoe and pressed her lips to his.
She tasted walnut and something else, maybe lacquer. But he did not take her hand, did not draw her closer. She felt no wind on her face, nor horse galloping beneath her. When she opened her eyes, she was still in the same dull, dusty attic. The nutcracker